This is Talk Is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. And thank you also to radioforall.net for archiving this stuff. Radio for the number 4all.net. All right, so this is another installment of the Encircle Films Q&A. You can see the Encircle Films events on at the Art House Theater here in Eugene on the third Thursday of the month. So this is from back in December 18th, 2025. Beethoven's 9. In early 2023, filmmaker Larry Weinstein sets out to make a documentary about Beethoven's 9th Symphony. It's supposed to be about how far we have come in the 200 years since it was written, but when world events pull Larry into his own film, the question becomes a deeply personal one. Beethoven's 9 is a documentary about music, but also about war and hope. It follows 9 unique individuals, including Ukrainian musicians, a deaf composer, a Polish rock star, a best-selling author, a legendary cartoonist, and Weinstein himself as they try to better understand the legacy of Beethoven's 9th, the composer's own struggles, the inspiration music can provide, and how humanity continues to look for hope even in the darkest times. So this features the Ukrainian orchestra, and so it's kind of heartbreaking, all this that's going on in Ukraine. But I just want to say, you know, I keep hearing, listen to NPR a lot, and I keep hearing them not taking the timeline back far enough, and kind of trying to support Ukraine by, we need to send more missiles and bombs and weapons to Ukraine. And I'm just saying, I don't think that's the answer. And you're just going to, it's just a never-ending weapons sales is all that's about. So what I've got here is Jeffrey Sachs. So the Q&A for Beethoven's 9 is mostly about music. But like I say, the film featured the Ukrainian orchestra to give some support to Ukraine. And I do support Ukraine. It's just that we need to just take the Minsk Accords. And I've said this long ago, and Jeffrey Sachs says this too. I have a short piece from Jeffrey Sachs here that explains the situation, at least from the left, of Ukraine. And look, Ukraine, we've rogered you, okay? We've totally screwed you. The United States, U.S. foreign economic policy, the corporate foreign economics policy, we have totally screwed you. And Jeffrey Sachs will go into detail about that. But really what we should have done, and again, Jeffrey Sachs goes into this a little bit, we should have brought Russia into NATO. They are not our enemy. They weren't. The Cold War was over. They should have been brought into NATO. And also, I've said this many times on this show, the reason Putin is in power, yes, he's a despot. The reason he's in power is because when the Soviet Union crashed, we just left it to the Soviet mafia to take over the Soviet Union and allowed the Russian oligarchs to put their money in the Bank of England instead of giving them humanitarian aid. And what you will find when you look at history, it's not about capitalism or communism, it's about imperialism. What we are imperialists, and we learned it from the British. And whether you believe in capitalism or not, the capitalism was a response to imperialism. And so imperialism is wrong. And yes, Putin is a despot, but if we went in there with humanitarian aid, if we took the carrot and stick approach and upped the carrot and cut back on the stick, we need to put humanitarian aid in all these areas and show them what it's like to be friends with the United States as it purports to be, right? So we should be giving them humanitarian aid. So again, humanitarian aid, not more missiles to Ukraine, and take the Minsk Accords. You're going to lose some property, Ukraine. But then they're already talking about bringing you into the EU. Let's bring everyone into a one world government, one world system that we all just trade culture and art and culture and a few things that you can't get anywhere else, but this global trade thing, we all need to be self-sufficient. Europe needs to be self-sufficient off of oil so that they're not dependent on Russian oil. India's been buying oil from them all this time, so that's where Russia gets their money for their weapons. And so it's just going to be a never-ending 20-year Afghanistan unnecessary war with the wrong country like we've done before. So, yeah, up the humanitarian aid, cut back on the military expenses, and the world will be a much better place, and spread the wealth, and you will spread the wealth out instead of concentrating it. As Orwell said, as I've said many times, the war is waged by the ruling group against its own subjects. They just skim off, they blow up your tax dollars and skim off money off the top, and that's what all this is about. So that is what needs to stop, and that's what we thought Trump was going to do when he went in there. But apparently the guys with black suits came in and put the kibosh on that. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Check out the Encircle Films events at the Art House on the third Thursday of the month. Thanks for listening. Support independent media. And support independent media.
Let me just explain in 2 minutes the Ukraine war. This is not an attack by Putin on Ukraine in the way that we are told every day. This started in 1990, February 9th, 1990. James Baker III, our Secretary of State, said to Mikhail Gorbachev, NATO will not move one inch eastward if you agree to German unification, basically ending World War II. And Gorbachev said, that's very important. Yes, NATO doesn't move, and we agree to German unification. The US then cheated on this, already starting in 1994, when Clinton signed off on basically a plan to expand NATO all the way to Ukraine. This is when the so-called neocons took power, and Clinton was the first agent of this. And the expansion of NATO started in 1999 with Poland, Hungary, and Czech Republic. At that point, Russia didn't much care. There was no border other than with the Königsberg, but other than that, there was no direct threat. Then, the U.S. Led the bombing of Serbia in 1999. That was bad, by the way, because that was a use of NATO to bomb a European capital, Belgrade, 78 straight days to break the country apart. The Russians didn't like that very much. But Putin became president. They swallowed it. They complained. But even Putin started out pro-European, pro-American, actually asked maybe we should join NATO when there was still the idea of some kind of mutually respectful relationship. Then 9/11 came, then came Afghanistan, and the Russians said, yeah, we'll support you. We understand to root out terror. But then came two other decisive actions. In 2002, the United States unilaterally walked out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty. This was probably the most decisive event, never discussed in this context. But what it did was trigger the US putting in missile systems in Eastern Europe that Russia views as a dire, direct threat to national security by making possible a decapitation strike of missiles that are a few minutes away from Moscow. And we put in two Aegis missile systems. We say it's defense. Russia says, how do we know it's not Tomahawk nuclear tipped missiles in your silos? You've told us we have nothing to do with this. And so we walked out of the ABM treaty unilaterally in 2002. And then in 2003, we invaded Iraq on completely phony pretenses, as I've explained. In 2004-05, we engaged in a soft regime change operation in Ukraine, the so-called first color revolution. It put in office somebody that I knew and was I was friends with, and am kind of distantly friends with the President Yushchenko because I was an advisor to the Ukrainian government in 1993, 94, 95. And then the U.S. had its dirty hands in this. It should not meddle in other countries' elections. But in 2009, Yanukovych won the election, and he became president. And in 2010, on the basis of neutrality for Ukraine. That calmed things down because the U.S. was pushing NATO, but the people of Ukraine on the opinion polls didn't even want to be in NATO. They knew that the country is divided between ethnic Ukrainian, ethnic Russian. What do we want with this? We want to stay away from your problems. In February 22nd, 2014, the United States participated actively in the overthrow of Yanukovych, a typical U.S. regime change operation. Have no doubt about it. And the Russians did us a favor. They intercepted a really ugly call between Victoria Nuland, my colleague at Columbia University now. And if you know her name and what she's done, have sympathy for me. Really. Between her and the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Piat, who's a senior State Department official till today. And they talked about regime change. They said, who's going to be the next government? Ah, why don't we pick this one? No, Klitschko shouldn't go in. It should be Yatsenyuk. Ah, yes, it was Yatsenyuk. And we'll get the big guy, Biden, to come in and do an attaboy, they say. You know, pat him on the back. It's great. So they made the new government. And I happened to be invited to go there soon after that, not knowing any of the background. And then some of it was, in a very ugly way, explained to me after I arrived how the U.S. had participated in this. All of this is to say, the U.S. then said, okay, now NATO's really going to enlarge. And Putin kept saying, stop. You promised no NATO enlargement. It's been, by the way, I forgot to mention, in 2004, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Bulgaria, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia, seven more countries in the not one inch eastward. The U.S. kept rejecting the basic idea, don't expand NATO to Russia's border in a context where we're putting in goddamn missile systems after breaking a treaty. 2019, we walked out of the Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty. In 2017, we walked out of the JCPOA, the treaty with Iran. This is the partner. This is the trust building. In other words, it's completely reckless U.S. foreign policy. On December 15, 2021, Putin put on the table a draft Russia-U.S. security agreement. You can find it online. The basis of it is no NATO enlargement. I called the White House that next week after that, begging them, take the negotiations. Putin's offered something. Avoid this war. Oh, Jeff, there's not going to be a war. Announced that NATO's not going to enlarge. Oh, don't worry. NATO's not going to enlarge. I said, oh, you're going to have a war over something that's not going to happen? Why don't you announce them? And he said, no, our policy is an open door. This is Jake Sullivan. Our policy is an open door policy. Open door for NATO enlargement. That is under the category of bullshit, by the way. You don't have your right to put your military bases anywhere you want and expect peace in this world. You have to have some prudence. There's no such thing as an open door that we're going to be there and we're going to put our missile systems there and that's our right. There's no right to that. We declared in 1823, Europeans don't come to the Western Hemisphere. That's the Monroe Doctrine. The whole Western Hemisphere, after all. Okay, anyway, they turned down the negotiations. Then the special military operation started. And 5 days later, Zelensky says, okay, neutrality. And then the Turks said, we'll mediate this. And I flew to Ankara to discuss it with the Turkish negotiators because I wanted to hear exactly what was going on. So what was going on was They reached an agreement with a few odds and ends. And then the United States and Britain said, no way, you guys fight on. We got your back. We don't have your front, you're all gonna die. But we got your back, as we kept pushing them into the front lines. That's 600,000 deaths now of Ukrainians since Boris Johnson flew to Kyiv to tell them to be brave. Absolutely ghastly. So when you think about your question, we have to understand we're not dealing with, as we're told every day, with this madman like Hitler coming at us and violating this and violating that, and he's going to take over Europe. This is complete bogus, fake history that is a purely PR narrative of the US government. And it doesn't stand up at all. Everybody understand, what does it mean to stand with Ukraine like Boris Johnson stands with Ukraine? It means 2,000 Ukrainians killed or wounded severely every single day. That's not standing with Ukraine. That is standing with the destruction of Ukraine. It's exactly the opposite. And so that's a purely Orwellian idea that we're standing with Ukraine by continuing this war. But I think there's another point that is important in this. I'm not without hope for a quite different reason. And that is that our politics is not determined by American presidents. Our politics is determined by the security state apparatus. And what is happening right now is not in America's security interest. And so they could change their mind. And President Putin said something actually very interesting in an interview in 2017, I think in Figaro, by the time that he had three presidents as his counterparts, Bush, Obama, and Trump. And he said to this reporter, French reporter, in 2017, he said, you know, I've dealt with three American presidents now. They come into office with ideas. But then men in dark suits and blue ties come to tell them how the real situation is. And you never hear of those ideas again. And this is from a very tough-minded leader who was himself KGB. He understands how the American system works very well. He understands what the CIA means for American foreign policy. He understands that American foreign policy is very deeply rooted. It's not this one wins and then Obama changes everything and then Trump comes in and changes. It's nothing like that, by the way. This has been a consistent foreign policy, arguably, since 1991, and arguably since 1945. And by the way, British foreign policy is the same. And I would say, arguably, British foreign policy vis-a-vis Russia goes back to 1840. It was around 1840 that the British government got the idea that Russia was a threat to Britain, to the British Empire through Central Asia, and the idea that that Russia was going to invade India through the Khyber Pass. And this became an idée fixe, and it became the basis for the Crimean War in 1853 to 1856, and Russophobia basically never abated. Of course, at two junctures, Britain aligned with the Soviet Union, or aligned with Russia in World War I and aligned with the Soviet Union in World War II. And the Soviet Union, of course, with 27 million dead, broke the back of Hitler's army, not Britain or the United States, which take all the credit for it. They can't even remember. They don't even invite the Russian leaders. And Russia bore the whole brunt of fighting the Wehrmacht. But then as soon as, you know, in the middle of 1945, after 27 million dead in the Soviet Union and an alliance with the Soviet Union, Churchill asked the War Office to consider, what about invading the Soviet Union now, Operation Unthinkable. In other words, let's continue the war. Germany just surrendered, now we should go invade the Soviet Union. That was not put as a defensive war game. That was an actual idea of Churchill. In the summer of 1945, and the United States said, no, actually, let's not have another war right now. But that's a kind of, that's a little weird, by the way. But that's how Britain has thought for, my point is these are very deep, consistent trends, and Britain taught the United States everything it knows, and we continue on the same deep trend. What we need is that the Pentagon and the CIA and the other intelligence agencies come to understand we're in a multipolar world. We face a nuclear superpower in China, a nuclear superpower in Russia. There is no meaning of victory. Tragedy is not an option, as far as I'm concerned, for a policy. And so we need a different strategy. And then somebody in a dark suit and a blue tie will come to tell whoever's president that we're doing it differently now. And that's what we can hope for.
Andrea Pleznarski is principal oboist of the Oakland Symphony and a member of Left Coast Chamber Ensemble. She is a graduate of the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia and received an MA in computer science from Mills College in Oakland. Andrea serves on the board for Eugene Springfield Youth Orchestras and on the advisory board for Pound Instaballet. Pound Instaballet. And last but not least, Greg Sutherland landed his dream job 39 years ago at the House of Records, where he's now the owner. His first encounter with Beethoven happened at the record store when he listened to Zubin Mehta's sluggish recording of the Eroica Symphony, and he walked away thinking that maybe Beethoven wasn't for him. But just a few months later, he heard George Sell conducting the Eroica. It was a life-changing experience from which he learned a great truth about classical music: performance matters. Now Greg loves Beethoven so much that he's written an as of yet unpublished biography about Beethoven aimed at young adults. Please join me in welcoming the panel tonight. I'd like to start off by asking each of you, and Mike, maybe you would be our first victim here tonight, for any thoughts or comments about the film. Did you like it? Was anything missing? What did you think?
Oh, is this on? Yeah. Well, when you're very close to a subject matter, you nitpick. And so I am afraid I had trouble turning off my nitpicking impulse about little details that bugged me. But in balance, what a heart felt and personal film. We really admire Weinstein for telling us his story rather than just a generic documentary.
Well, I think for me, just listening to this music, just at any time when I'm not actually playing it and I have to be focused and concentrating, I get very verklempt. I mean, it's very emotional music for me. I've performed it a lot. Including a tour, actually, that was, I'm remembering this now, in 1992, we were in an orchestra in Germany, a student orchestra, and it was like the first time that there were East Germans and West Germans and all Europeans together. And we performed all over Europe, including like at the Olympic Stadium in Rome with like 20,000 Italians all, you know, excited with their lighters, actually, in the dark. It was very wonderful. But I mean, it's a piece that people can really grab onto. And so I think for me, I loved that he added the element of having Gabriellina Frank there, because I think her experience is very relevant. Especially the later Beethoven works that you perform or hear, often they just are incredibly repetitive. And for example, the scherzo in this piece has many repeats that often aren't performed, which makes it very long and exhausting for us and for the audience. But I think it's an element of his deafness that he just kept hearing things in his head. And also, there are also later things in Beethoven, like the scherzo, that are this bum-ba-dum, bum-ba-dum, and it always makes me think about heartbeat, that his heartbeat was probably a real impulse in a lot of the music that he wrote. So I enjoyed the film, though.
How about you, Greg?
I did enjoy the film. It was very moving. I was near tears many times. It was a little diffuse. There were so many characters, so many stories. And then the director comes out with a story. So it was really, you really had to be on your toes as a viewer. I'm not really a film guy. I'm more a music guy. So I don't watch many films. But that also gives me a sort of naivete about when I do watch them. And yeah, I just felt very moved by it. I also was thinking about how difficult it must be to perform this symphony. I have heard many, many versions, and there's just so many issues with it. There's so many ways there can be problems. I mean, four singers, a whole choir, the movements can be taxing. Sometimes the slow movement on the records goes too fast, and you can just see the musicians looking at their watches, like, okay, let's get through this, and then we get to the good part. So it's a difficult symphony to perform. And I thought the performances in this film were pretty good. I mean, we only heard excerpts, but
yeah.
But yeah.
Andrea, maybe that's a good segue to you. As a performer who has performed Beethoven's Ninth numerous times, what is it like to be a musician and to be performing his music?
Well, this piece is usually about 70 minutes long, and there are other works that are about 70 minutes long that we perform, Mahler symphonies, and other long works. But this work in particular is very exhausting and very intense for the orchestra at all times. I mean, there's just never a moment off. You're always, kind of on. You're always playing. You're always producing sound. And it's just, like, physically exhausting and mentally exhausting. And it's a journey. I mean, the first movement is sort of the most contemporary piece of that time. I mean, it still feels contemporary to me. It still feels fragmented and odd, and mostly because there's no center pitch. Like, it just kind of, like, weaves around. There's no center tonic ever in this piece, and in the first movement. So it takes a really long time for you to grab on. And then, as I was saying, the scherzo has many repeats. It can be quite long and exhausting. And then that third movement, I love that he highlighted it, because honestly, it is really, it's an incredible thing to be on stage for that, because there's just all these beautiful melodies swirling around you, and it's a double variation. There's an A and B section, and each section has its own set of variations. And then, of course, the last movement is also another set of variations, basically, which is incredible and just keeps building and building. And you just think, oh, maybe it's going to be over soon. But no, there's like another giant thing and then a giant coda at the end. But it's a journey for all of us when we're on stage, for sure.
Mike, when we talked earlier before tonight, I know that you've had a relationship with Beethoven that goes back to when you were very, very young. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, my father was the Duck Marching Band director, so he had a large record collection. And I used to get out my toy animals when I was about 3 or 4 and set them up like an orchestra, and Beethoven's Ninth was very much in the repertory, and there was a pelican who was especially good interpreter from the podium. So I would say 3 is when I really took to the symphony.
I have a question for you, and Greg, I know you dispute it, but Mike here described you to me as possibly Eugene's biggest Beethoven fan. What is it that has drawn you to Beethoven? Hey,
what? My wife knows that I'm a big fan, and so she bought me this shirt.
Whee!
So she bought me this shirt, and it came yesterday. So I told her I would wear it tonight. Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. I'm sorry, what was the question again?
I think you proved the question. But beyond that, what inspired you to write a bio about Beethoven for young readers?
I actually was inspired by Mahler's Third Symphony. I was laying down on the floor one day, listening to Mahler's Third Symphony, and just closed my eyes and started thinking. And I started thinking about how Mahler's life was almost like a Grimm's fairy tale. He wrote a piece called Songs on the Death of Children, and his wife warned him, I don't think you should do that when having a three-year-old child, you know? And it ended up that his child died. And so I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, wow, kids would probably really understand that, you know? And so, yeah, it developed into this whole idea to write a series of biographies about composers. And I started with Beethoven because he was the first classical composer that really connected with me. And also, Beethoven's life is just so tragic. And I mean, okay, you talk about the deafness, but Beethoven was a very sick man. I mean, he had terrible, terrible stomach problems and diarrhea. I mean, just bringing it down to the basics, you know. He had a tough life. He was a very lonely man. He didn't have many relationships. I mean, he had acquaintances and a lot of people who knew him, but he never had a long-term love relationship, so there was never anyone who Beethoven could show all that love to. And I feel so sad for him because of that. And so I think that he put that all into his music.
Nice. Mike, I know you've taught Beethoven on and off for decades, you said. Is there anything that most people don't know or get wrong about Beethoven?
I don't know. I don't know most people exactly, but I understand the question. And one story that really moves me is that we all think of Beethoven in our popular imagination as a friend of freedom and an anti-aristocrat. And I think he was that. He really did detest the system of aristocracy, and he felt that there should be a system of merit. And he, of course, saw himself as meritorious, so much so that at one point he was mistaken for a nobleman in the Austrian courts, which had a three-tiered system. At the top, aristocrats would be judged by an aristocrat, and all their business would be heard in those courts. Beethoven's was an unscrupulous businessman, and he double-sold exclusive publication rights to lots of works. And the result is he was often being sued, often by French and British publishers. And all of that, those trials would be heard in that elite court system where he would be judged by a fellow aristocrat and generally defeat these commoner publishers. Then one day they found out the error, that he was in fact a commoner. And he wrote in his diary that day, "Today, all of my legal papers were put into a wheelbarrow, trundled through the worst streets of Vienna to a court where now their fate will be determined by magistrates better suited to determine ownership of a disputed cow." In other words, what I'm getting at is he was really human in the sense that, I don't know about you, but I have some contradictions in my life. And I instead of hiding them, I just say, whatever, I'll celebrate them and own them. Contradictions in Beethoven are what I like about him. He isn't one thing, and he isn't an easy person to generalize a path forward from, but instead a human being. And maybe that's a better kind of person to chart a path forward from. I like that he liked being an aristocrat while hating aristocrats.
That's awesome. Andrea, do you want to add anything about what people might get wrong or should know about Beethoven?
No.
Okay. No, that's fine. That's good. Let's go ahead and open it up to audience questions. Phil here has a mic, which will make it a lot easier for everybody to hear your question.
Yeah, that'll be handy.
And I see a hand right here.
Hello. Oh. What were some things that you were going to nitpick about the movie?
I shouldn't have said that. Okay, one that bothers me is this discussion of Schiller and the word Freiheit versus Freunde. Schiller scholars have discredited that claim 50 years ago. It is not seriously entertained amongst Schiller scholars. That bugs me, because there was a version of the ninth that was presented with the word Freiheit substituted for Freunde, freedom for joy. And that was 1884 France. It was the French who actually saw in the Beethoven career a kind of a friend to the revolution, which he was, and also a leader in a kind of free-thinking French democratic ideology, because he was from Frankfurt. It's easy to... he's from Bonn, which is very near the French frontier. He followed the events of the French Revolution with great care. And so I just feel like giving Bernstein credit for that substitution, it bugs me. That's one. That's just one.
Any other questions? There's...
If you don't mind, for the three of you, each of you, what is your favorite recording that we could listen to of the ninth? Which symphony? What performance?
René Leibowitz and the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. I once walked into a record store here in town called the Musique Gourmet, run by, does anybody remember the Musique Gourmet? No? Okay. He was kind of a crusty old guy who was not always nice. But I got him to warm up a little bit. I wore him down. And one day I went in there and asked him, all right, I want you to recommend to me the best ninth symphony that you've ever heard. What is it? Have you got it here in the store? And he walked over to his Beethoven section and handed me that CD, and damn, he was right. Because like I was saying, it's hard. It's hard to do it all well. You know, there's this, you might like some movements in, say, the Bruno Walter version, but maybe the singers aren't so great. Or you might like a version with four top-notch singers, but the other movements aren't so great. So it's just tough to get it perfect. So that's my recommendation. René, R-E-N-E, Leibowitz, L-E-I-B-O-W-I-T-Z. And he's French, so that's why the Leibowitz, even though it's E-I, it's pronounced E, I think.
Mike, do you have a favorite?
I have a corny answer. The next one. Anytime human beings want to go to all the trouble of putting this on for me, I am going to be well pleased. But that's a little bit of a silly answer. I kind of do like old instruments. And so I like the Harnoncourt Orchestra of Europe version, because they tried to the extent possible. Like, it's played on catgut strings instead of the metal wire strings of a modern orchestra. And I don't know why, but I kind of like listening to those out-of-tune brasses and the troubles of what people would have heard at the time, because the instrument technology was so different than the modern orchestra. But I really am not a... I nitpick movies. I don't nitpick performances nearly so much.
Any other questions from the audience? We have Phil.
Nicholas Harnoncourt is the conductor.
The mic, please.
Nicholas Harnoncourt. I don't want to spell it because I think I get it wrong.
H-A-R-N-O-N and then Court, C-O-U-R-T. He's really good with ancient instruments, but I want that symphony to shake my seat. And so... I hate to quibble with Mike's choice, but I feel like those ancient instrument performances are a little too polite. Just my opinion.
I think we have a question.
Yeah. So you guys all like Beethoven. So for all of you, I was just wondering what your favorite piece from Beethoven is, and if it is the ninth, why is it the ninth?
Okay, I don't know if I can answer that. I mean, for me, you know, Beethoven is, maybe the violin concerto. I that's a piece that I just always feel very drawn to. It actually starts with oboes at the beginning, and it and the oboe, like a lot of the time, Beethoven uses it as the little hero, you know, that always kind of leads everybody back to like, it's okay, we can get here, you know, don't worry. And so I always love that about it, and it is a really wonderful piece. In fact, when I wanted to find a canary, like a singing canary, I went into a shop with my phone and put on the Beethoven Violin Concerto on YouTube, and I looked in the cage for who responded, and I found this incredible bird that loved Beethoven. I mean, he adores it, and I always knew. Anyway, so that's the Beethoven Violin Concerto is something I'd really say I love.
Nice.
Me next? Or yeah. Mike, do you want to go next?
Yeah.
Tough question, sir. Very tough. If I only get to choose one, and I hate to do that, so I may give you two, but I would say the String Quartet number 16, Opus 135, I think. That's one of his last pieces. He was completely stone deaf. And yeah, you can hear his suffering in that piece of music, and it's just four instruments, and yeah, the proportion of it, the way everything works out together, the unity, and then individual movements, just, you could just, you know, focus on one movement or listen to it as a whole, and it's just an amazing piece. So I would say that one, if I have only one choice.
Greg took mine. I like the 16th string quartet too. But I'll pick a different one that doesn't get trotted out much. I really like his Coriolanus Overture, because I like that play. And as a film music scholar, because I'm first and foremost that and not so much a Beethoven scholar, I really love meditating on how spoken theater in the large cities of Europe of the 19th century featured live orchestras most of the time. And the Shakespeare plays, but also the classics, all enjoyed this incidental music that captures kind of the spirit of what I think of as great film music. That is to say, it rouses the audience, it reminds them of the main themes, it embellishes the emotional impact of the spoken word. And so I guess I'll take an oddball choice and go with Coriolanus.
It's a great overture.
I'm sorry I took your choice.
It's okay.
We have a question there.
Well, I'm curious, you're saying that the instruments obviously are different now. And so I'm thinking about when the woman, I'm sorry, Gabriella Lena, when she was talking about how she feels the vibrations from the piano. So how would a piano have differed then that Beethoven would have been playing on?
I think it wouldn't be nearly as loud, for sure, and also wouldn't have the ability of the pedals that are so common today. But yeah, definitely not as huge of a sound, the piano. There are lots of recordings, actually, on period pianos of that time, which are interesting because they don't have the same, like she was saying about how like long the resonance was, that's just not as possible on those pianos at all. There's much more of a decay of the sound.
It's the steel reinforcement inside the instrument. The Broderip Corporation sort of patents that around 1830. And Broderip was a manufacturer in London. And so the result is Beethoven never had a piano reinforced with steel on the inside. And as a result, if you played too loudly, you could simply break them. And there are stories, and I don't know if they're true or not, that Beethoven, as his deafness was encroaching, broke many pianos. I've heard that story. I don't endorse it. I don't know if it's true.
It's a good story.
Do we have another audience question? Okay. I think it's... Yeah.
Classical music, only the conductor improvises, right? But I mean, each performance is totally different. But anything on where's the improvisation in classical music?
Yeah, we don't improvise usually. We kind of stick to the score, and that's mostly our job, is to interpret what the composer actually wrote on the page. I mean, that is like, as a classical musician, that is our job, really, essentially. And some composers are very adamant about that. I mean, there's stories about people like Ravel, for example, who would just be absolutely hopping mad if people didn't follow his directions on the page. You know, he'd just walk out of a performance and you know, storm out. So. Not really. I mean, you know, they seem improvisatory sometimes, especially to us. But no, they definitely are not improvising. I mean, they're conducting pretty much what the score is. And sometimes things, you know, expand or get faster or slower or, you know, or louder or softer. I mean, sort of based on what the acoustic is like or how things are feeling on the stage. But in general, they also stick mostly to what they have planned, I would say.
One thing I can add. There is improvisation allowed during when a soloist is on stage, like say during a piano concerto or a violin concerto, and sometimes composers will leave open space during, say, a cadenza where somebody can improvise there, and they don't stick exactly to what Beethoven, say, wrote for the solo, and they're allowed to deviate a little bit, but it's only with, you know, a certain amount of bar structure that they can do that, and then they have to come back around to join the orchestra.
I would add one more thing. Another area where you encounter it is in opera. The structure, the early 19th century of opera arias often has repeats, and the singers would be expected to sing differently the melody the second time through. But I want to recommend Chopin, because he was a great improviser on the piano. He published works, but they were the products of an improvisatory process that his... I'll call her housemate. They may have been lovers, but I'm not sure. George Sand was her pen name. She described how he would sit at the piano and effortlessly play his pieces, and then would come the painstaking and horrible process of trying to translate what had come effortlessly to his fingers into musical scores that other pianists could then recreate. And I often wish that pianists would be more daring and play near Chopin and go ahead and just... you know, try something else. I think I'm like you in that I wish there was a bit more improvisation in classical music, but alas, but Chopin at least was a great improviser, as many pianists were of that century.
This has been great. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time. Can you please join me in giving a big round of thanks to our panel? And as you're leaving tonight, I hope that the messages of joy, love, hope, and also the power of being together in community as we are here tonight stay with you. Thank you very much for being here. The people.
Thank you.